The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. Get the power to do more with Sky's best ever Wi-Fi.
I've been talking about a book that has me utterly absorbed, and it's an area of history that I haven't really taken any great interest in until this book landed on my desk. It's called Madhouse at the End of the Earth, the Belgica's Journey into the Dark Antarctic Night. Think of The Terror, that TV show with Ciarán Hinds. Think of Shackleton and Crean, and think of Adventure and Daring Do. The author, Julian Sancton, joins us now. And Julian,
good morning. How are you?
Congratulations on your book. It's really a wonderful achievement. Delighted for you.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
Welcome to the show, by the way. I was intrigued to know that this all started in some respects with your interest in an article about a trip to Mars.
Yeah, so I was at my desk at Departures magazine at the time, and I was flipping through the pages of the New Yorker magazine, and there was an article about how NASA is planning on sending men and women to Mars, and they're studying the effects of confinement and isolation and extreme environments on the psychology of these astronauts. And the article began in unexpected fashion with a short summary of this expedition that I'd never heard about, the Belgica expedition. And in those three paragraphs, it evoked the image of people going insane near the South Pole. And that was just so gothic. It was just such a great detail. And then when I learned that one of the key factors in the survival of those who did survive was the presence of the American doctor Frederick Cook, who was later maligned as a great fraudster, a guy who lied about being the first to reach the North Pole, lied about being the first to reach the summit of the tallest mountain in America, and was imprisoned for 7 years for running a Ponzi scheme, the kind of combination P.T. Barnum and Bernie Madoff. Mm. When I heard that that guy was the hero of this trip, then that was just so irresistible. I love a heroic anti-hero. Mm. That's what I decided to learn more about.
Okay, so must have been so exciting. Let's assemble the cast of characters that would populate the Belgica, the boat.
Sure.
that took us into the dark, as you say, Antarctic night. This reads like it's almost like an Agatha Christie setup of everyone has an interest in this thing being successful as it happens. But what a cast of characters! And let's start, I suppose, with the man at top. This is de Gerlache himself.
Yes. So it was his idea. Adrien de Gerlache was a Belgian aristocrat, a young man, probably 26 when he came up with this crazy idea, and it was a absurd passion for a Belgian at that time to have any seafaring dreams, because it was a country with no maritime tradition to speak of. They had no navy, a bare bones merchant marine, and any adventurer worth his salt at that time would have been more tempted to seek his fortune in the Congo. Mm. But de Gerlache had no appetite for colonialism, and he had his eye on colder horizons, and decided that he would heed the call of the World Geographic Societies, who at that time had decided that the exploration of the Antarctic, which was almost entirely unknown at that time, was of the utmost priority. And so he assembled, or rather scraped together, a ragtag group of what semi-qualified Belgian sailors he could find, a somewhat more reliable group of Norwegian sailors, and Eastern European scientists, this aforementioned American doctor. Mm. A lot of his staffing decisions were questionable, but there were a few that certainly made the difference later on. Cook was one, and another was the first mate of the expedition, a Norwegian man named Roald Amundsen, who would later become something of a legend for having blazed through the Northwest Passage, mm-hmm. and beaten Robert Falcon Scott to the South Pole, and possibly, if what we know now is accurate, it's always questionable these achievements in polar regions, but possibly was the first to the North Pole. So for Roald Amundsen, the Belgica was a testing ground, an apprenticeship of mm-hmm. sorts, mm-hmm. and it's funny that the great legend of polar exploration should have learned so much from the great anti-hero, the great huckster of polar exploration, Frederick Cook, but he did. He revered him.
As I was reading about the cast of this particular adventure, Julian, I was thinking of it's like a Marvel, you know, crew. And if it was a Marvel crew, it would be Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, it is, and they all brought something to it. And I think of it as one of those Men on a Mission movies, like the Dirty Dozen.
Yes, yeah.
And despite my education as a historian, I can't help make those cinematic comparisons either.
Well, it is cinematic as an experience, as a read, and as a story. And as you say, once you hear Gothic, you know, we're going right back into into that particular zone. Looking at them, even they have a great look. They're very young. They could fit into the East Village having beers in modern New York. Do you know what I mean? They look like hipsters.
They really do. I mean, they did. It helps that they let their beards grow. But later in the expedition, when the sun returns, the morale was so low that Frederick Cook decided that he needed to do something to keep spirits up, and so he gave everybody haircuts. And he had this habit of just cutting part of their hair, and then letting them and refusing to cut the other side. So I'm sure they looked even more like East Village hipsters at that point.
Yeah, for sure. So many places to go. Let me just talk about how the anthropologist and the naturalist on board were. They're like children looking out the window, the porthole, going, stop here. I want to get stop here. I want to go over there. You know? And yet
exactly.
the captain or the commandant was saying, stop asking. We have to get further. You're in trouble. And yet their curiosity is infectious right down through the passage of time for us now in 2021.
Yeah, absolutely. And those were two incompatible aims. From the beginning, de Gerlache wanted to frame this as a serious scientific expedition. But at the same time, he realized that in order to get the public behind him, in order to he needed to promise some kind of exploit that would electrify the press and the public at large. And, you know, the discovery of the mating patterns of the Gentoo penguin probably wasn't going to do the trick. So he promised the attainment of the South Magnetic Pole, which at that time had not been located. That's somewhat different from the South Geographic Pole. It's just where the center of magnetic activity in the South, in the polar regions. So whereas a thorough scientific expedition required that the scientists take as much time as they can, investigate every tide pool, every glacier, the attainment of a distant geographic goal required that they move as fast as possible. So those two aims ended up clashing and delayed the expedition. And by the time he set out for the geographic pole, it was far too late in the season, and the winter ice was setting in. And so he had a decision to make: do I come home empty-handed? Am I going to be able to show my face to my illustrious family and wonder what the Belgian press will make of this, or do I nevertheless pursue a relentless southern route, knowing full well that the ice will surround the ship and close in and possibly crush the ship? But if we do survive, we will be the first to endure the cruelties of an Antarctic winter. And that will be something we can crow about back home, because in exploration at that time, the real goal was to have a great story to tell, and he certainly succeeded there.
You've set up this story in many ways that now people can read the rest for themselves. But in the way you describe them, there are many shadows cast on the characters of this ship, the shadows of fame, the shadows of shame, shadows of ambition, and that great big yawning shadow of legacy.
Yeah, and those were, everybody dealt with those in different ways. De Gerlache was hamstrung by it. This fear of, it was as much a pursuit of glory as a fear of humiliation. But he was not, despite those dreams of glory, he was not himself a conqueror. And so that's something that I found somewhat admirable about him. Even though he made this decision and lied to the men about his decision to get caught in the ice, he claimed it was an accident, and he claimed that they were actually making progress towards the north when they were making progress towards the south, which defies belief to me. But He was. You mentioned these shadows, and for me, that's something that really drew me to the men is the idea that you know nobody is the storybook version of themselves in these kind of adventure stories. They're all nuanced, like all of us. And for him, what I found the most appealing was that he was a pacifist. He was at a time when there was the world was caught in a jingoistic frenzy that would soon lead to war. He put together what I believe to be one of the first international scientific expeditions, laid the groundwork for a geopolitical miracle, which is the last 120 years of peace in the Antarctic, the only continent that has never seen war or poverty or genocide. He didn't, unlike anybody else in the or unlike most explorers, I should say, in the heroic age that followed, he didn't lay claim to any land. He didn't name a land after his king, which was expected of him. He was appalled by the Congo. So I think people who followed made different decisions. But the fact that he was just a model of international cooperation, and in fact a model that serves as an inspiration for both the International Space Station and hopefully for the aforementioned missions to Mars.
Mm. The biggest character, apart from the breathing human beings on the boat, in your magnificent book, is nature. And
yes,
there is an expression in America that has followed us across the Atlantic, which is awesome. It's awesome. And I say that with this cynical, dry skepticism with which I just pronounced it. But you know, like that coffee's awesome. You know, it's not. I'll tell you what's awesome is nature in the Antarctic. And
that is the perfect word for it.
Isn't it just? And, and even to the point where they start having illusions like a mirage in the desert. You can have that and suddenly the ice formations become a city or a bridge because they're going mad. I mean, that's the name of the book. And nature's presence in this book is, like, I felt completely reconnected to my respect for nature because of how big it is.
It was a maddening environment. It was nature, especially down there, is a trickster, and not only the landscape, which was made entirely of water. One of the men said, it was a parody of terra firma. It looked like a desert. It looked like you could trust every step, and looked like there were mesas and mountains in the distance, as reliable as nearby towns. But it was in constant flux. Every step could have been a light covering of snow over a hole or a patch of slush, and if you stepped on it, you would almost certainly die. You sink beneath the pack and die of hypothermia or drown. And the light as well played tricks. There were things that we've never seen outside of polar environments. Fog bows, parhelic circles, sun dogs. You mentioned the beautiful southern lights, which were mesmerizing. And then you mentioned the mirages. There's such a thing as a Fata Morgana, which is particularly awesome, to use your word, mirage, where distant objects seem to float over the horizon or to be greatly extended or distorted or inverted. And indeed, in de Jolache's log, which I was lucky enough to access, he describes this in the most – he's one of the most remote humans in the world at that point, and yet he describes what he sees in the distance as a city by the sea, complete with a lighthouse shining towards him. So they couldn't believe their eyes, they couldn't trust their eyes, rather. And so that definitely set the stage for a descent into madness as the sun disappeared for months.
The other aspect of nature that really struck me was the ferocity and the power and the cruelty of wind.
Yeah. It's there's only two forces that affect the pack ice, and it's the same two forces that affect water. It's the current and the wind. And to think that those two things were responsible for all their suffering, not only the incessant howling and the rigging, but also for the pressure of the ice, which is moved primarily by wind and current, and that the ship was at the mercy of these things, and especially of wind, something that can't even be touched or seen. Mm. That the wind should threaten them every day with destruction. I found also pretty gothic.
Gothic, but also you were able to write noise. I could hear the wind in your book.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, one of the things that I really insisted on doing, although I didn't go as far as I could have, was to go to Antarctica.
Oh, wow.
Myself. And a lot of the sights and sounds and even smells are things that I didn't feel like I could rely on the diaries and firsthand accounts to recreate. So the wind is definitely, we've all heard wind, but down there it's particularly strong and maddening. So that was something that I'm glad I was able to go down there to fill out those details. And another thing that surprised me about that, it was if I was relying simply on the photos of Frederick Cook, and they were the first ever taken of the Antarctic, by the way, and they're sublime.
Yes.
But I would have been, if I had just been relying on them, I would have been describing a landscape in black and white. And it certainly wasn't that. I mean, I was struck by the vivid colors of the ice and the whole range of blues and even greens and yellows that the ice can take on.
The history nerd in me is absolutely bowled over by the wealth of kind of prima facie evidence, if you like, that you could pull together to produce this book. I mean, right down to the log books from De Jolaches that you had the pleasure of meeting his great-grandson. And obviously, they were very prolific diary keepers on this boat.
Yeah.
As well. I mean, this was these guys were very history friendly.
They really were. I mean, I thought that one of the reasons this story hadn't been properly told before was because there was not much of a historical record. And boy, was I wrong about that. Of the 19 men who left South America for Antarctica, about a dozen kept some kind of detailed record. And I was lucky enough to find a lot of them. I mean, the one that eluded me, which I'd be desperate to take a look at, although it's impossible, was that of one of the men who lost his mind and never recovered. Mm. When the ship got back with slightly fewer men to Punta Arenas, the men decided that they would burn his. He fled into the woods. And then they decided that they would burn his diary rather than let posterity see the horrors it contained.
Hence, all of the madness. We have two great explorers in the Irish history books here, of course, Ernest Shackleton and Tom Crean. I don't know if you've come across them in your studies, Julian.
I have. And in fact, the Endurance, Shackleton's famous ship, was built for none other than Adrien de Jarlache. It was something of a sister ship to the Belgica. It was built in the I believe by the same shipbuilder, and it was originally destined to De Jarlache, but he had run into financial trouble and then called up his good friend Ernest Shackleton and said, "Hey, do you need a ship?"
That's amazing.
The rest was history.
That is absolutely amazing. And you know, your book reminded me of something that I think you know, my parents' generation probably read as adventure stories made up back in the day. But of course, you know what? Yours is nonfiction. It just feels so old-fashioned in the most glorious way.
Well, you know, I wrote the kind of book that I wanted to read, and I think one of the models for this was Alfred Lansing's Endurance, which told the Shackleton story so brilliantly, and it was written decades ago, and it was a model of how to do nonfiction in a novelistic way.
Great.
Without sacrificing the seriousness of it, and so that's something I really strove to do. These stories, you mentioned that they were all prolific writers. They were, and the reason is they were romantics. Even the scientists, when you read their writing, it reads like a polar horror story. Even the naturalist, even the geologist, they were influenced as much by Jules Verne and Edgar Allan Poe as they were by their colleagues and fellow scientists. One of the reasons that I was able to kind of achieve that effect and create that atmosphere is because they did. Their descriptions are vivid, colorful, spooky, you know, what have you. All the range of emotions that great writing can summon were summoned in their diaries. So. Yeah, that definitely aided my task.
Well, you channeled their writing and I think their mindset just spectacularly well in your book, Julian. Thank you so much for being with us this morning and indeed for the book. You've opened my mind to a whole new world. I'm excited to read more and more, but what a great start. Congratulations and thanks for your time today. Wish you well.
Thanks so much, Ryan. It was a pleasure.
Likewise. Okay, Julian Sankton joining us. He is the author of that wonderful book, beautiful and brilliant. It's called Madhouse at the End of the Earth, the Belgica's Journey into the Dark Antarctic Night. And like I say, I don't think you have to be a sailor. I don't think you have to be a history buff. I just think you need to be interested in humans to enjoy that and indeed nature. The text number, as always this morning, is 51551.